In each of the evening sessions now for the next 4 or 5 days, we're going to have a look at this diagram here, and we're going to have a look at the stages of development that we go through in the shamatha practice. So we're going to look at this diagram in some detail. But before we begin that, is there still any questions or comments anyone would like to bring up regarding any of the practices from today before we do that? Looks like everything's clear, or maybe not. Okay, so let's go straight into the diagram then. So a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about, of course, are listed on the back here. So you see on the diagram there's a lot of numbers, and each number has a description on the back. And as we saw the other day, right at the top on the back it said, shamatha is attained by progressing through the 9 stages, relying on the 8 antidotes to abandon the 5 faults. This is accomplished through the 6 powers and the 4 mental engagements. So here we're saying that we progress through 9 stages on the way to shamatha. Shamatha is actually the diagram in the middle at the top, and so there are 9 steps or 9 stages to achieving shamatha. So today we're going to look at the first 2 stages. So let's have a look down the bottom of the diagram. So we see the meditator, of course, down the bottom here. And as we've already seen, the 2 main tools that we use in this practice is mindfulness and introspection. And that is symbolized in the meditator. In their left hand, they have a rope. So that is the rope of mindfulness. And in the right hand is the hook of introspection. And then we see the elephant. The elephant is the mind itself. And the fact that it is black is symbolizing this dullness or laxity. The monkey is symbolizing discursive conceptual thought in general. And the fact that it is black is symbolizing this excitement, the most common form of distraction. And so we see these diagrams winding along this windy path, which has 6 sections to it. And each of those is called the 6 powers. And so on the first stage of the practice here, which over the back we see is called setting the mind, what we see here is that the monkey and elephant are running wildly ahead of us, which is indicating that at the first stage of practice, what we really come to realize is that our mind is completely out of control, that our mind is constantly caught up in dullness and distraction. And so also we see on the first diagram the flame. The flame there is symbolizing the amount of effort we need in our mindfulness and introspection. So as a beginner, of course, we need to put a lot of effort to work with mindfulness and introspection. And the first road here is called the power of hearing, meaning that we begin the practice by hearing about the instructions, hearing the instructions from a person or even maybe reading a book. So through the power of hearing, we get to see the instructions for the practice, and then we apply the instructions. And what we notice, of course, is at the first stage, what happens, of course, is we try to focus on the object, and so far we've been working with the breath. And maybe we can focus on the object for a couple of seconds, 2 or 3 seconds, and then all of a sudden we're gone, completely distracted. And often it's quite some time, maybe some minutes, before we recognize that we're distracted. And then, of course, we come back to the breath again. And then again, after a few more seconds, gone again. So this is describing the first stage of practice, that very rarely are we actually on the object. Most of the time we're completely distracted or completely dull. Now, many people, when they begin to meditate, Of course, this is the normal experience. But of course, what happens is that we come into this practice with some sorts of expectations, that we sort of have this expectation that, you know, my mind is not too bad. I think I can focus on the breath sort of okay. Maybe I'll get a bit distracted, but I think I can do that okay. And of course, when that doesn't happen, and rather we only focus for a few seconds and then we're completely distracted for many minutes at a time, then we come to the conclusion that we can't meditate, you know. I just can't meditate, you know. In fact, since I've started meditating, my mind has got worse. Because before, my mind used to be sort of okay, but now it's gone crazy, absolutely crazy. So I must be doing something wrong, and I definitely can't meditate. And it's usually worse than that, because in a group setting like this, then what happens is often then people open their eyes a bit and look around and everyone else seems to be super still and they think, I'm the only one who can't meditate. Everyone else seems to be going quite well. I'm just useless. I'm hopeless. Don't worry. If this is your experience, you can meditate and you're actually making progress, because the first sign of progress in this practice is simply to notice how chaotic and out of control your mind really is. Until we sit down to do this type of meditation, we really often live in the illusion that our mind is sort of okay, that our attention skills aren't too bad. But actually, when we have to focus on a given single object for any period of time, we come to see how poor our attention skills really are, that we're constantly distracted and constantly dull. So if this is your experience, that's okay. It's actually a sign of progress. You've made it to step one, so good work. Keep up the good work. So let's have a look now a little bit what Alan Wallace says about this stage. So also in his book, he also describes these nine stages. So we're going to read a little bit from page 13, where he begins to talk about this first stage. And he calls this directed attention, this first stage. So let's see what he has to say. The first of the nine stages leading to the achievement of shamatha is called directed attention. The sign of having reached this stage is simply being able to place your mind on your chosen object of meditation for even a second or two. If you are trying to direct your attention to a difficult object, such as a complex visualization, this may take days or weeks to accomplish. But if your chosen object is your breathing, you may achieve this stage on your first attempt. The faculty of mindfulness is crucial in shamatha practice. Mindfulness in this context differs somewhat from the way some contemporary meditation teachers present it. So remember I said that how the word mindfulness now is used in the modern day is often a little bit different to the Buddhist definition of mindfulness. So remember here, mindfulness is, or smriti in Sanskrit, or sati in Pali, is simply the faculty, our ability to remember the object, our ability to focus, hold an object without becoming distracted. And here he says, Vipassana teachers, for instance, commonly explain mindfulness as a moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness of whatever arises. In the context of shamatha, however, mindfulness refers to attending continuously to a familiar object without forgetfulness or distraction. The first stage of directed attention is achieved by the power of hearing. According to Buddhist tradition, the most effective way to acquire fresh learning is directly from an experienced, knowledgeable teacher. First you hear teachings, then you follow up with reading, study and practice. The power of hearing refers both to listening to instructions and also to reading about them, especially if no qualified teacher is available. One of the first signs of progress in shamatha practice is simply noticing how chaotic our minds are. We try to remain attentive, but we swiftly lose our minds and slip into absent-mindedness. People who never sit quietly and try to focus their minds may remain under the illusion that their minds are calm and collected. Only when we try to direct the attention to a single object for minutes on end does it really become apparent how turbulent and fragmented our attention is. From a Buddhist perspective, the untrained mind is afflicted with attention deficits and hyperactivity. It is dysfunctional. Like a wild elephant, the untamed mind can inflict enormous damage on ourselves and those around us. In addition to oscillating between attention deficit and hyperactivity, the normal untrained mind compulsively disgorges a toxic stream of wandering thoughts, then latches onto them obsessively, carried away by one story after another. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorders and obsessive compulsive disorders are not confined to those who are diagnosed as mentally ill. The normal mind is prone to such imbalances, and that's why normal people experience so much mental distress. Such disturbances are symptoms of an unbalanced mind. These two dysfunctional tendencies seem to be intrinsic to the mind. Hyperactivity is characterized by excitation, agitation, and distraction, while attention deficit is characterized by laxity, dullness, and lethargy. When our minds are subject to these two imbalances, we have little control over what happens in our minds. We may believe in free will, but we can hardly be called free if we can't direct our own attention. No philosopher or cognitive scientist needs to inform us that our behaviour isn't always guided by free will. It becomes obvious as soon as we try to hold our attention on a chosen object. So this is the first stage of the shamatha practice called setting the mind. So again, in setting the mind, that's characterised simply by being able to hold the object for a couple of seconds, and then most of the time we are heavily distracted or heavily dull. But then if we, of course, continue the practice, then we can get to the second stage of practice. And here the second stage is called continuous setting. So this is on the second curve of the road, and this is this road here is called the power of thinking or reflecting. And so this is when we think a little bit more about the practice and we start to get a little bit further in the practice. And here what we see is that the elephant and monkey are not running so fast anymore, and they both have a little bit of white on the top of their head. That white on the top of the head is the factors of stability and clarity. So now by stage two in the practice, our stability and clarity is improving a little bit, to the point where we notice certain periods in our meditation where our mind seems to be settled a little bit more. Maybe we can hold the object for a minute or two before we become distracted. But still, at stage two, we tend to be distracted for quite long periods of time. So even at stage two, we tend to be more distracted than we are on the object. But in stage two, we're starting to notice some periods where our mind is settling down a little bit, mind calming down, and we're able to hold the object for a little bit longer, maybe again a minute or two. So let's have a look at what Alan Wallace says about stage two of the practice here. So this is on page 30. Halfway down. In the second of the nine stages, continuous attention, you experience occasional periods of continuity. But most of the time, your mind is still caught up in wandering thoughts and sensory distractions. Don't be misled by the name of this stage. Continuous attention doesn't mean that you can maintain unbroken continuity for long stretches, but that now and again you can remain centered for a sustained period without completely losing track of your object of attention. However, time and again you will lapse back into coarse excitation, completely forgetting about the intended object of attention. When you can occasionally maintain continuity of awareness of bodily sensations for about a minute, you have reached the second stage. The second stage is achieved by the power of thinking. The challenge in this phase of practice is to sustain interest in the object, and you can do this by thinking about the instructions between sessions. If you are a seasoned meditator, you have probably found that involuntary internal commentary on your practice can be an obstacle. Even the ongoing thought, here is the in-breath, here is the out-breath, can be an intrusion. However, internal commentary can also be useful, especially in the first two stages of shamatha practice. If you're thinking about the practice, at least you're not thinking about something else. So again, here, this is relating a little bit to counting the breaths, which is what's coming up next. But also, of course, in the beginning stages, sometimes we need to sort of remind ourselves of what we're doing in terms of mindfulness and introspection and so forth. Another way to use the power of thinking to help calm the distracted, wandering mind is to count the breaths. This is like using training wheels when first learning to ride a bicycle. While the practice of mentally counting breaths involves a kind of thinking, it can help to simplify the conceptual mind. Instead of having many things to think about during the meditation, you reduce your thinking just to counting your breaths. It is important, though, that in striving to maintain continuous attention, you don't lose your earlier sense of relaxation. The stability of your attention should emerge from a relaxed mind, not work against it. Okay. So this is the second stage of the practice. So just a couple of other general points about this diagram today. As we said, was that the when we talk about distraction, in the text they use the word excitement, because the most common form of distraction is to get pulled away by the so-called sense pleasure, something pleasurable. And that is symbolized in this diagram here. We see sort of above stage two in the middle there, we see a bowl of fruit. So that is the taste, the object of taste. Beside that we see a silk cloth, so that is touch or tangible object. Above that we see two round objects, they are symbols, so that is sound. And then to the left of that we see a shell with some perfume in it, so that is smell. And then diagonally above that we see a round object, which is a mirror. So this is visual objects. So these are the representing the five sense objects, which are the most common form of distraction we have in this practice. And we see this flame. Remember, the flame was the amount of effort we need in terms of our mindfulness and introspection. So we need to put a lot of effort as a beginner, but then as we see, as we go through the stages, the flame gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually it disappears, meaning at the upper levels of the practice, our mindfulness and introspection, we don't really need to put effort. They become spontaneous because of how well they are developed. So then it really becomes effortless. But as a beginner, of course, we need to put a lot of effort because our mindfulness and introspection are not very well trained. One other thing I'd just like to mention this evening, and that is number 19, which is the monkey in the tree. So halfway up on the left side, we see the monkey sitting in a tree with some fruit in its hand. And if we look over the back at number 19, it says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha meditation, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. So this is something that we have to be aware of, is that any thoughts in this practice is an obstacle. So if we're focusing on the breath, and then suddenly we have some virtuous thought of wishing to help someone, then at that time, of course, that is a distraction. We need to let it go and come back to the breath. Because but of course at other times, then we need to cultivate those thoughts outside of this meditation. We need to actively cultivate generosity and loving kindness and compassion. But in the middle of shamatha practice is not the right time to do that. One other thing that I'd like to mention in that regard is that what you're going to find, and this happens as we particularly start to progress further in the practice and the mind really starts to quieten down and become focused, then what you're going to find is that you're going to have a lot of things popping up, a lot of great ideas popping up in your mind. This is relates to what we talked about this afternoon about attachment and creativity, is that when the mind really becomes very still, that's when the creativity comes through. So what you're going to find often in this practice, as the mind settles down, you're going to have from time to time these spontaneous thoughts arising, and it may be a solution to a problem that you've been working on. It may be just some great idea that you'd like to implement. When these things come up, then that's not the time to engage in these thoughts, no matter how virtuous or wonderful these thoughts are. Put them aside. So you can just say, okay, that's a great idea. I'll deal with that after the meditation. If you're worried about forgetting these sorts of things, then what you can do, of course, also is have a little notepad next to you and just jot down one or two key words and then go back to the meditation and then deal with that or work with that outside of the meditation. Because otherwise, you're going to have quite often, particularly as you progress, you're going to have these things coming up. And if you entertain them at that time, of course, that's just a distraction. So just let it go and deal with it after the meditation. So that's all I really wanted to focus on for the first two stages. Does anyone have any questions about any of these first two stages of the practice? One more point, and then we'll go on to this evening's practice. What does it really mean to be at a stage? For instance, we said stage two is, you know, that when you can hold the object for about a minute or two often. So what it means to be at a stage is, if that is your average experience, then you are said to be at that stage. Now, you may find that in certain meditations that you can hold the object for much longer periods, which would be equivalent to maybe stage three or stage four, but it's just like a one-off. It's a one particular meditation where things are going really well. That doesn't mean you're at stage three or stage four. Or there may be a particular meditation where you're always completely distracted as if you're at stage one. But if your normal experience is that, you know, holding it maybe a minute or two on average, that's what it means to be at stage two. If that's your average experience, you can sometimes be better and sometimes be less. So that's what it means to be at any one of these stages, if that is your average experience. Okay, so that's all I wanted to talk about this evening, stage one and two. So tomorrow night we're going to look at stage three and four. So what we'll do then now again to finish off this evening, we're going to be doing the mindfulness of breathing the full body in the corpse posture again. So finding a nice comfortable posture. So spread yourselves out. And so here, of course, we're in this meditation, we're emphasizing relaxation, but of course not to the point of falling asleep. So if your neighbor sort of gets too relaxed and starts snoring, then you have permission to gently nudge them. So if you get nudged, it means that you're snoring and someone's sort of waking you up. So if you find that you are really just falling asleep, then what I can recommend is to do this practice with your eyes open. So try that, and that may help for those of you who naturally just fall asleep quickly. So again, we'll do about 15-minute meditation. So again, lying flat on the back, feet a little bit apart, hands to the side, a little bit away from the body, palms facing upward. So letting go of any external distractions. Simply allow your awareness to descend into the body. Right down to the ground. Becoming aware in particular of the sensations of where your body is touching the floor, the cushion. And then if you notice any tightness or tension in any part of the body, then use the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension. And bringing your awareness to the area of your face, softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. The mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eye soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment, through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, wherever you most distinctly notice any sensations associated with the breath. And maintain that ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. using the out-breath to relax, to release any distractions, and very gently return to focusing on the breath. And to help overcome dullness or simply being spaced out, you can use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh our focus on the breath. conclusion, we can dedicate all the positive potential that we've gathered today towards the goal of developing our attention skills, towards the goal of developing a calm, clear and focused mind, and also dedicate it towards the goal of cultivating loving kindness toward ourselves and others. And also, it's often traditional as part of the dedication to recite a short dedication prayer. So while I read out a dedication prayer from the great Indian master Shantideva, you might like to think about the words. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So again, in your own time, you can slowly finish the meditation, rolling over onto the side and then very gently sitting up.